All right, so this will be episode number 2 of the Andy Chanley podcast, calling it that because the Henny Youngman podcast was taken. Larry Morgan is joining me in the studio. Now, Larry, I did this, did one episode with Josh Fligger.
Wait. Who's got the Henny Youngman podcast going?
It's his estate.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
All right.
No, I don't know. Do you have an interest? Because I want to diversify.
I'd rather be doing that than this.
Yeah, that's true. He's got industry cachet. Larry Morgan is here, and you know Larry from radio across the dial here in Southern California, currently at K-Earth 101, and previously at Go Country, KKGO, for a day and a half.
I don't think that's true.
You don't include that on your resume.
I don't think that's a rumor I've heard. Much like that classic episode of Dallas, I believe that was just all a bad dream, Sue Ellen.
The name of your program over there was I've Got a Mortgage, right? Is that right? And prior to that, for several years at 100.3 The Sound, from whence I am going to be extricated very soon. And last week, these first episodes are getting to know all about you. Who's who in the zoo? The regular players that are going to be involved in this, my hope anyway. We talked to Josh Fligger, who you know.
Yes.
Many years working at 100.3 The Sound.
A fine young man.
A fine young man, an upstanding citizen, and also a cinnamon. And
yeah, he has that scent. Is that a cologne?
Yeah. It's a body spray.
Okay.
And have you ever run into a woman named Cinnamon? She's probably a stripper.
Well, it's funny you say that because we have somebody on our street team here whose name is Cinnamon.
I'm sure she's wonderful.
She is not a stripper. She's a fine, young, upstanding college student.
But she smells like vanilla body spray. But
she does have a lot of piercings, though. Just saying.
Last week, what we did was, or the last episode, we just kind of got to know a little bit about Josh and his upbringing and mine, by a comparison. Mm-hmm. And that's what I wanted to do today with you, these first episodes, just to let people know stuff that they never really got to know about you, because you do music-intensive radio, like I've done for the most part for the last several years.
Yeah.
It's where you kind of get out of the way. You're a curator of the music, but you step away and let people enjoy the music because they probably don't care if you have a cold or just bought a new house or whatever.
Oh, I tell them anyway. Yeah, no, you're right. You and I have both worked in situations where there's not a ton of time to get personal, although you can reveal little drips and drabs about yourself along the way because you don't want to just be a robot.
Yeah.
But you're right. And also, generally, you and I are very different from other morning guys in that I think we genuinely don't think that other people care about us as much as most morning guys do.
Yeah, we have a little bit of humility.
Yeah, a little bit.
A little bit.
Tiny bit.
A little bit.
It's in there.
A little dabble, do you? I remember the first time I met you, and I remember the first
we had dinner, right?
Radio break I heard with you. No.
No, didn't we have dinner with the bigwigs?
No.
Was that not the first time?
No.
Oh.
No. I don't think so. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I need to parlay things into the proper place. But I remember my first day at 100.3 The Sound. It was actually, I was supposed to start the following Monday, I think, June 2nd of 2008. But they brought me in that Saturday before just to check over the equipment and do a little, dry run through, not announce ahead of time that we're doing it. Just go on the air and do a couple of breaks and see what it sounded like. Kevin Scott was the engineer, the chief engineer at the station. And Kevin's no longer with us, but makes us smile every time we think about him for various reasons.
Oh, yeah.
But I remember the program director, Dave Beesing, takes me into the studio with Kevin Scott. It had been the beat prior and V100 prior to that,
right?
And the microphone, I don't want to get too X's and O's with it for people who don't care about this kind of crap, but the microphones were set up for hip hop,
right?
And hip hop means your voice just has to kind of cut through, and there's echo on it a little bit sometimes, and it just has to cut through heavy beats, loud, bass that's pushed to the front.
Right.
And so I open the mic to talk, And it was as if I was shouting down the longest, dark tunnel ever. Like, my voice just evaporated the moment. I couldn't hear anything, and couldn't hear it in the mix. And it was just a weird. You know how people say that when they hear their own voice, who don't do this for a living, yeah, they hear the voice on the tape recorder.
Is that
like,
what I sound
That's
like?
Not me.
That's
not.
Yeah.
But it was so off-putting. And I had been out of the business for a little while at that point, so there was that on top of it.
Sure.
And then he comes in, and there's this huge mixing board with 10,000 buttons on it. And none of them are labeled.
No. What? But
there's just these white buttons. So here's a gang of, you know, six buttons for this pot, and there's six for that pot, and six for that. And he's like, okay, so when you're ready to do a break, what you do, hit that button and that button, and I'll label them eventually. But, you know, then you can go over here. And if you want to hear yourself in real time after the delay, then you can hit this button over here. And I just start glazing over, and
wow,
I look out the window at the 19th floor on Wilshire Boulevard at the beautiful view and think to myself, this job isn't going to last, so I'm just going to enjoy this view for a few minutes. It did stick around, and then a month later, you came around,
right,
and you were the second person to be added at The Sound, I believe.
I thought Julie Slater was actually...
Okay, so you were third.
Yeah,
you were third.
I was the first morning guy.
You were the first morning guy.
Julie had been there for a little
that's,
bit.
Okay, that's right. So a week or so later, you come in, and I show you what I had learned, mm-hmm, through Baptism of Fire, and show you the mixing board and you know the program that runs all of the music and all that. And then you do a shift after that, and I leave.
Yeah. This was my first, I did an evening shift.
Yeah.
For the first time.
Yes.
Just as my own kind of warm-up.
As a test, yes,
yeah,
exactly. So you were on after 8 o'clock. I was doing 3 to 8 at that
right,
point.
Right.
So you came in, and I'm driving home, and I know it was summertime because... it was a July because it was still light out as I'm driving up La Brea.
Yeah.
And I hear you do your first break. And we were a AAA station then.
Yeah, right? That's right.
Playing, like, you know, 27
adult,
Jennifers.
Yeah, adult alternative, they like to call it, whatever that means.
Yeah. And it means something different now. But I hear you do a break, and you were talking about Eddie Vedder on the Into the Wild soundtrack, and you played a song, and after it, you're like, you know, I just saw this movie, and his music, it's like an extra character in the film. It just added something that I can't quite quantify. And you played the song, and I had seen the movie and heard the song and heard it in a whole new way then, and I thought instantly, I don't like this person.
Because I made you think.
Yes.
Yeah,
you made me think about what I was listening.
I'm so sorry about that.
And you've done that a couple of other times, isolated incidents, since then. But that was my first that I remember interaction with you at all.
That might be true, because then I think the dinner I'm thinking of was after that, mm-hmm, which I remember we were taken out, as far as I know, the only time we had a meal paid for other than a Christmas party was with some Bonneville bigwigs. That was the company that owned the station at the
Mormons.
Time. It was you and me and Dave Beasing, our program director, and other people I
Haley
can't remember.
Haley Jones?
Haley, our music director.
Music director was there?
At the time might have been there.
And Peter Burton, did we go to City Walk?
No, we went somewhere off of Robertson, I think. Somewhere in that little Beverly Hillsy area.
I don't know that I was invited to this.
No, you were there.
Oh, okay.
You were there. I remember it distinctly. I remember it because I was telling everybody a little bit about me and my family and that I had a son in college. And I remember one of the Bonneville people, a female, say, "Oh, wow. You don't look as old as you." Something about my age. And I remember thinking, oh, that's nice. Hey, wait a minute. It was one of those, like, oh, I'm really old, but thank goodness I don't look it.
Yeah.
I definitely look it now.
You are totally looking it.
Yeah,
now.
Absolutely. But I will tell the
story. Did I amaze
you
in that moment?
No.
Okay.
I was listening to you on the air because I was a big fan of the station. I mean, I was, we joke about 27 Jennifers, but I was also hearing Jellyfish and Crowded House.
There
were bands.
Lots of singer-songwriters.
I was texting Haley at the time, who I wasn't even working there yet, and I was texting her just title and artist with exclamation points after her,
right,
going, are you kidding me? And I was really passionate about wanting to work there. I thought I was going to work there part-time. And when I sat and talked with Dave Beasing, the PD, about the format and about the music, and just he picked my brain a little bit because we went back a little ways. And then clearly, just out of the blue, he called me and said, I've been thinking you should do mornings here. And that was completely. I wasn't pitching myself for a job. I was hoping to work a shift a week there.
Now, you had worked at Star before that?
I had worked at Star 98.7. I had worked at a AAA here in town that was around for a little bit that preceded you.
KSCA?
Yeah.
You were KSCA?
FM 101.9. With Nicole Sandler and Mary Lee Kelly, and Mike Morrison was the program director on air there. And I did part-time there, but I was on a lot, and that was an amazing place. I mean, it was that kind of...
It gets that, like, KMET, that kind of halo of, or, one of those radio station that means a lot to people because it stood apart a little bit.
Very few people, unfortunately, but the ones that were listening to it were passionate about it.
Yeah.
And also, it was the kind of station where you would find out...
It was the Cagney and Lacey of Los Angeles radio. Goes off the air, lots of letter writing.
That is a super, super distant pull. But okay, I'm going to let that, it's your podcast, I'm going to let that go.
All right.
But you'd find out things like, God, I'm totally blanking on the name now. You find out that artists were actually listening to it, and they would call occasionally, and you would be kind of shocked. And it was also like, the Rembrandts came in and did the Friends theme acoustically, and I got to do the hand claps with them. Yes.
Nice.
It was that kind of place. And I mean, you only get a couple of those, I think, in your career that are never going to last.
Yeah.
And it's pretty great to be a part of it.
Yeah. They aren't built because they're not, like a KCRW, they get public money.
Right.
And they get pledge money.
They don't need ratings.
They don't need people to listen. It doesn't matter if everyone does or not. It's if the ones who are listening are willing to open up their pocketbooks and help support.
Yeah, but it's interesting, Andy, when you see something like look at the television model. You have high-quality product from Netflix and Amazon or whatever. Mm-hmm. The audience must be spread out.
But
so,
once again, subscriber-based.
Yes. That's what I'm talking about. I mean, how does radio... We're not going to solve radio's problems here right now, but isn't there a place for an eclectic, outlet for music that can survive?
On the FM dial?
No. Maybe not terrestrially.
No. No. And that's what a lot of people don't understand. I hear a lot. Criticisms that I'll get about radio is, why do you guys play the same old crap, time in and time out? It's just the same shit. And they're right. They're exactly right.
Yeah.
Because here's what we learned right after The Sound went on the air. Right after. And The Sound and, you remember 103.1, Indie 103.1.
Yeah.
That everyone loved.
Santa Monica?
Yes.
Yeah.
Jonesy was on there and so forth. Everyone loved that station. They said they did, and they said they listened all the time. But when they started handing out these PPMs, these personal people meters,
mm-hmm.
Portable, whatever it's called, purple people eaters, it looks like a pager.
Yeah.
And you wear it on your belt. You wear it around like a pager. You look like you're expecting a call from 1984 or your drug dealer. And it picks up a carrier wave, an inaudible signal that's buried on every radio station, and each one has a different one. It's their personal footprint.
Right.
And so if you're around a radio for 6 minutes and you stand in front of it for long enough, it will register you as a listener to that radio station.
And credit
that
station.
I don't know how much. I still work in radio, and there are strict rules about how much of this we can talk about. I guess I just can't talk about it on regular radio. They get poopy.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're not manipulating.
I'm out of work.
Yeah.
Like, I care.
By the time this is out in the public, your station might not even exist anymore.
It's true. So, anyway, these became currency. These became the way they did things. It used to be, you write down in a diary.
Mm-hmm.
I listen to Mark and Brian from 6 a.m. to 10. And
by the way, isn't that the most accurate way of measuring listening?
Someone writing you a Post-it note. So they did that. It's accurate in this sense. It's accurate in the sense that if someone is listening, if they were a dyed-in-the-wool Mark and Brian listener,
if they were loyal.
Yeah. Then their car was, they turned it to KLOS and snapped the knob off and never changed it.
Right.
So when they did get in the car, they were exposed to Mark and Brian. Right. So in that sense, yes, that's accurate.
But if you're a punch and a rounder,
right,
you're not even going to remember most of the time who you were listening to.
Exactly. Well, here's maybe to put a finer point on it. Let's say you're in Best Buy. You're thinking, you know, I need to buy myself a ghetto blaster. And you're standing in front of the boom boxes, and they're all tuned to Czechoslovakian, crunk music.
Happens all the time.
Right. Then if you stand there for 6 minutes, you are put down in their data as a Czechoslovakian crunk listener.
Yep.
Now, you would never tune that in on your own. You wouldn't even know where to find that on your own. But let's say you're standing there, and a commercial comes on for Jim's Honda down the road. We're just down the street from where you are right now, right next to Best Buy. We're having a special sale. The next five people on the lot get $5,000. What? So you're like, oh, my God, I was going to go look at Hondas. And in that sense, it's accurate because the message that the advertiser was trying to get out got to you, and that station should get credit for that. And that makes sense. But what it did is it made the byproduct is that it made unfamiliar music impossible to play on the radio.
Right.
If you played something that's angular or that people aren't used to, they'll tell you. People will say, I love listening to new stuff, KCRW and Morning Becomes Eclectic and what's that station out in the valley, KSON. All of it's just great. And I like being – that's what they'll say. And maybe when they're in the mood for that, they tune to that. But when the kids are in the back seat arguing, throwing spitballs, and somebody cuts you off in traffic and you're 10 minutes late to soccer practice, what you want to hear is something that is recognizable and comfortable to you.
Yep.
That's just human nature.
Yeah.
So people will say they want to hear all that stuff, but in reality, it's familiarity that rules the day. Now people say, okay, what about a station like Kiss FM? They always play new stuff. They play the new stuff every 70 minutes.
Right.
They cycle it back around. It's not even top 40 anymore. It's top 30, maybe.
Maybe 20 songs.
Top 20. They'll recycle them. That's why every time you punch in, you're going to hear one of those new songs that you wanted to hear.
Yeah.
So that's how that works. They just do with a frequency, and they crank people through.
And they're also either going to play a song that's like, if the new Taylor Swift drops and that's getting a ton of attention, they are pretty sure that that's going to be a safe bet.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's something that's established in some other area. Not a lot of stations, even at this level in Los Angeles, they're not breaking new records, breaking new
artists.
Anymore.
That's
really hard to do.
They're waiting for
other analytics to come in. How hot was it on the internet? How many views did somebody get? I mean, my kid is in the music business, and one of the first questions he's asked when he talks to managers and labels, and he stopped doing that, talking to those people.
What's your social media reach?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
If you don't have 20,000 followers on Twitter, then they don't want to talk to you.
Yeah.
And that's the way it's gone. So that's the primary question, primary criticism. Why don't you guys play more of this? Well, the fact is you get punched in the balls if you do that.
Well,
and for a station that's already was flagging in the ratings a little bit at the time, you can't afford to do that.
And most people, and it's hard to kind of point back at the audience and say, hey, we are the way we are because of you.
Because
it sounds like we're wagging our finger. But the fact is, the guy that you were just doing a really horrific impression of, why are you good? Although I know that guy.
I know him. He comes out to all my appearances.
Most people are totally fine with the familiar and the, yeah. I mean, they're big. Honestly, the station I work for at K-Earth is based entirely upon big hits from the past that you love, that you know you can sing along to.
Yeah.
And we're doing very well with that.
These are multi-million dollar organizations. Yeah. Do you think they didn't think this out?
No,
there's research that's done. There are questions that are asked. Everything that's done is done for a specific reason because there's a lot of money in the line.
Unless you're dumb or egocentric about what you think your taste is, if you're running a radio station, you are doing everything you can to find out what your audience really wants.
Right.
And then having to fine-tune that, and then trying to find a way to engage or surprise or just keep them around, maybe around that.
Right.
That's basically what radio's become, is here's a bunch of songs you're going to know and you're going to already love. Now can we either bribe you to listen or entertain you enough to make you stick around or find some kind of flashy object that makes you think this is... And this is not a big cigar. I mean, this is. It's also the same with other entertainment industries.
Okay, with like, a newspaper, you get out a newspaper.
What?
Exactly.
What's that?
They've gone on to their reward for the most part. But they were promoted to glory. But when you look at a newspaper, I ran a newspaper when I was in college. It was a 20,000 daily circulation paper, and I was in charge of, I was a managing editor of it. The sales department would come over with a budget. They would give me a stack of papers that were, you know, there's a page for every page in the paper. And they had big squares and rectangles drawn on it. In those big squares and rectangles, that's where they sold ads. The rest of the space I could fill with news. Mm-hmm. I could fill with stories. I could fill with pictures. So everything, newspapers, radio stations, television stations, do you think they're here to entertain you? No. It's the last thing they're here for. It's a business, and they want to sell advertising. And in the process, in order to do that, they entertain you. But also, the thing about well-programmed stations like K-Earth is that if I have K-Earth on, I'm going to the beach, I got my transistor radio, I turn it on, and I'm listening to K-Earth, I'm not going to hear anything I hate. I'm not going to hear anything that's objectionable to me. People around me won't mind if I turn it up. It's going to be good feeling music the entire time, stuff that makes your day go by fast.
And even if you hear one that you go like, that you're either tired of or you just don't like.
You know, the next one's going to be fine.
The next one's going to be great. Yeah. And I worry that we're sounding like super cynical here about this industry. But the fact is, one of the things that you and I have both been doing most of our lives is kind of being in those situations where we know this.
Yeah.
And hopefully what we're bringing to the table as part of these places is that thing that elevates it slightly to be the surprise or be the entertainment or be the compelling aspect of
the
it.
The corporate shill.
Yeah.
that's what you were looking for, right?
That's not at all what I was trying to say. No. Okay, and we're back to cynicism. Okay. And it's come full circle.
it's you try to be... You know, I got a compliment early on in radio. This is what my 29th. I'm in my 29th year of radio.
Wow.
And like in my second year or something like that, sent my one of my air checks, you know, a recording of my shift off to a consultant.
Oh, boy.
If you work in radio in the last 60 years, you've been introduced to consultants.
Yeah.
And they sent back a summary of what they thought I did on that tape. And it's the biggest compliment I ever got in radio. The guy said, it was Alex Demers, if anybody cares.
Oh, wow.
Said, Andy doesn't sound like a DJ. And you might think that sucks, that's not what you're trying to be. No, he says, he sounds like somebody you'd like to go have a beer with after his shift is done.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, that's fantastic. Fantastic.
Yeah,
that's
totally
exactly what I want. And do people know me from what you know? Do they know you from what they hear on the radio? A little bit, but do they really know who I am and what I'm interested in? Not all of it, but just you can get a general vibe from people pretty quickly. You can estimate your potential for having a relationship with them immediately, and that's what someone comes away with. I was chuffed by that, man.
Yeah. I think that what you're aspiring to do in that room is to make a connection, no matter how slight it is. If there is still one thing about radio that has an impact, is that it is the closest thing to that sense of a companion that you have. If it's local and if you know that somebody's there right there in your city, that still has enough impact that people go, oh, okay, this is familiar. This is that guy that's in my car that I like his sense of humor. And if we did hang out, we'd have a blast. And just their sense that he's talking to me. It's still showbiz because we elevate things a little bit. We hype things a little bit. Nate, aspects of our personality are pushed a little bit.
Yeah. Some are sublimated.
Yeah. Indeed. But that's what radio, music radio has always been about, which is I'm talking directly to you. I'm not talking to a crowd. That was supposedly the idea.
And isn't that weird, that feeling? It's almost psychotic. When you do your shift, when you're on K-Earth at night, you're in a room talking to no one in that room, but you've visualized all the people that you've met and all the people that you've heard from and that have written in. So you're visualizing, you're having a conversation like it's a two-way conversation.
Yeah.
As relaxed as this, and you're having this conversation with them, that's bonkers.
It's interesting, though, because I was just thinking about this because there is something inherent in those of us who got into this industry, much like you look at a stand-up comic, and they're all really damaged people.
Oh yeah,
I mean there are exceptions clearly, but they're all working something out. They're more comfortable on stage in front of people than they are. Now, radio, on the other hand, is a very different circumstance. And I was just kind of analyzing the psyche. Somebody asked me last night, in fact, how did I get into this? And my answer was, I was looking for a creative outlet. I was growing up in West Texas. I aspired to, like, make movies and stuff. It was very hard to do back in the day, pre-digital video. And I also was an
too
introvert.
Too wussy for football?
Yeah, totally. I'm still too wussy for football. It hurts just watching it. Ooh, that's so violent. I don't know what that voice was, and please forgive me. but it was, I wonder if you're this way, too. I mean, I was essentially an introvert. I was not big, loud, life of the party guy. But I had this ability to, you know, come up with creative thoughts, have funny ideas. Mm-hmm. And radio was perfect because it gave me that outlet, but didn't put me directly in front of anyone. Right. And also it felt at least like I was the only one controlling things. You were told what to do or whatever, and you were given parameters. But to a certain extent, you crack that mic open, and people ask us this all the time. Is that like written down? Did you write a script? It's like, no, this is all basically improv. It's all off the top of your head. You're composing what you think you're going to say, but a lot of times it's just spontaneous. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was the perfect mix of getting to be silly, letting these ideas out, playing around, basically being an idiot, mm-hmm. and doing it somewhat isolated so I didn't feel too invested in it. It's the opposite of stand-up comedy for me, which is I'm much more comfortable in a quiet place with no eyes upon me doing this. I've gotten more comfortable being in front of people, but you know, I'm curious to know if you have that similar background, motivates
kind of, yeah. I think that a lot of people in radio have a face for radio, and some have a voice for newsprint. But
let's name them now. There's
name names. No, I think that radio is the text messaging of media.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
You know, texting versus a phone call. Somebody calls you, you got to get on the phone with them. You got to have, you know, a one-on-one conversation. You know, and maybe you've had a glass of wine. Maybe you're relaxing with the kids. Maybe you're at dinner, whatever. And you just don't feel like doing that. Text message, you can take it in, and move on. And you don't need to act on it right then. Same way with radio. Yeah, you can come in and do your improv for someone, do your 30-second act, and put your joke out there and let it float towards Mars and push the button and play the song, and you don't have to hear what everyone's reaction to it was. You don't have to wait around for people to throw tomatoes or a standing ovation. And in that sense, yeah, it's you just send it, and there it goes. That's the thing I like about radio, is that everything that we say is immediately on its way to Mars. It's immediately on its way, you know, chasing Voyager, and that will never be here again. Okay. And the next time you start over, you do the whole thing again. So that's different from stand-up comedy, where you have an act, and you will go through that act because you've honed that act. You've practiced it.
And you get immediate response when you're in front of people.
Right. If you kill with something somewhere, you're going to use that at the next place. And that kind of thing. Radio's completely different, because if I come on every day and make the same joke, people will notice, man, that guy knows one joke.
Yeah.
And which I've heard that criticism quite often.
Yeah.
But
Ellen.
I radio is 130 years old.
Yeah.
It survived television. It survived the internet. It survived satellite radio. It survived, digital music services and it survived all these things, but it can't survive anymore. I mean, you remember, was it 1990 or something? When was it? When was the 57 Channels and Nothing On by Bruce Springsteen?
That's right.
When 57 Channels seemed like a whole shitload?
Yeah, that's the joke. I mean, that's the joke of the song.
Do you remember those cable boxes that came? It was like 12 buttons,
yep.
And then the clunk, flipper clunk, on the clunk, left, clunk, through the, you know, the 36 total.
Right.
That was the first cable box we had.
Right.
So we switched from three networks. You know, ABC, NBC, CBS, and one UHF, or one local and one UHF channel.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then we upgraded to this thing with 36 channels. How will we ever watch them? And then Bruce Springsteen, you know, comes out with, because then they upgraded to that brown box that had the two red LED numbers and that trapezoid-shaped remote with the
right,
soft buttons on it.
Right, which you're just having to mash and point straight at it.
Oh, yeah.
Try and get it going, yeah.
So they get that, and you could go up to 99 channels at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an onslaught. I have 8,000 channels.
Yeah.
You know, you go in DirecTV, it goes up into the thousands. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it goes up to 9999. They don't necessarily have something on every single one, but
right.
There's room for them.
But they're all of the music channels that are on there.
Yeah.
Some are pretty good. And all of the pay-per-view channels and all of that. The internet, you know, every day it doubles itself. And there are so many places for people to get their own stuff and agendize their own entertainment that radio... It's becoming irrelevant. It feels like it's becoming irrelevant.
Yeah, except radio doesn't have to be, as long as radio doesn't define itself as this terrestrial signal on the FM or AM frequency. I mean, if you look at the way TV developed, and radio generally has been a distant follower of how did TV adapt? I mean, radio had to adapt because when TV became prevalent and in everybody's home, dramatic storytelling on the radio disappeared because suddenly there was a visual attached.
Right.
Okay, so we've seen satellite radio appear, two competitors. They merged.
Right.
They could only sustain one. Apparently, they're still sustaining. They're keeping satellites out in space. Internet radio is a thing, but that hasn't become the thing. It's going to be in cars. It's on your phone. As soon as the data issue, you know, becomes no longer an issue,
right?
You're going to have a way to have on-demand music or entertainment or whatever.
Yeah.
Podcasting is a thing. We're doing it right now. So is this radio? I mean, what is the next level of radio?
It might as well be. I think you stop calling it radio, or you stop, you know, thinking of it in those terms, and you start thinking of content.
When I watch Netflix and Amazon, I'm watching TV because it's coming, you know, through that same box I always used. So, I'm not saying you don't call it radio, but radio needs to stop thinking of itself as this thing that only comes from a terrestrial signal.
Yeah.
And I'm not smart enough to kind of know how they do that.
I don't know. The biggest thing that radio has going for it, the biggest virtue radio has, is its cost. It's absolutely free. If you have a car,
you mean to the consumer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you have a car or you have a radio, you've got free entertainment.
Right.
Radio doesn't cost a cent to the average person.
You sit through advertising.
You sit through advertising. Just like, you know, you pull up YouTube and now you sit through advertising.
Yeah.
That's their business model. But radio doesn't cost a thing, and that's its biggest thing. And it used to be the biggest thing was it's live and local.
Mm-hmm.
So I get someone who's in my community, someone who is, you know, dealing with the same things I do. Hey, how about that 405 today, huh? You know, someone who knows what I'm going through to some extent, but that got blown away. I don't care that Bill Clinton got a blowy in the Oval Office. I could not care less. As a matter of fact, I think he should have stood up and said, you know, the French part of my ancestry wants all of you to go pound walnuts. It's none of your business what I do. I carry around missile codes every day. Get bent. What I do with for sexual excitement and gratification is up to me. I don't care about that. What I care about is the Telecommunications Act of 1995,
mm-hmm.
where he basically said, you can own just about as much as you want. One company can't own a whole bunch. Now, I don't hate the big radio players, you know, CBS and Cumulus and Intercom and so forth. I, you know, hate the game, don't hate the player.
Right.
They're playing by the rules. They're playing strictly by the rules. One of the rules said, I have to find a new job.
Right.
And it's all business. And I don't hold that against them. But that got rid of mom and pops.
Yep.
That got rid of that, that singular voice of, you know, this community broadcasting where you felt like, you know, people are doing something that relates to you, and that was the biggest virtue that radio had. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's free, but it also it speaks to me, and there's a friend nearby that knows what I'm going through.
But that act made it a more corporate product. What it didn't do was what the internet did and what modern technology did, which was take away for a new generation the importance of radio. My kid grew up listening to the radio in the car with me. The moment he was out on his own, going to college or whatever, I don't think he's tuned in a terrestrial radio station since he was in the car with me. So I don't know that, you know, the conglomeration of radio necessarily, if that hadn't happened, I don't know that mom and pops would still be able to survive right now based upon what is going on with what the next generation of listeners is going to be.
That's true. You know, things...
What I point the finger at with the corporations now is they did what they did. You're right. That's a business. What they haven't done is innovate. What they haven't, the big money companies, the iHearts and the CBSs and the Intercoms, about to be very big, and maybe Intercom will be that one. But they're not developing what's next. They're trying to kind of limp along
right.
with what they've
Well, you know what,
what's
funny is what's next? The thing that they're most excited about? Podcasting.
Yeah.
It's the thing that they're starting to do, and you're seeing more of it. Everybody's got a podcast. The New York Times has a podcast. You know, I would imagine that every media entity will eventually have some kind of podcast.
Well, it's essentially the same version of what happened with your television channels, which is it exploded to so many different choices.
Yeah.
And I think that's good, because what happened with that act in the 90s that and people started gobbling up radio stations is they found a way to operate them, quote, more efficiently, which meant
sure.
a lot of voice tracking, a lot of disc jockeys out of work, a lot less local coverage, and a lot less local disc jockeys. I think what they're finding now is that, oh, that doesn't necessarily satisfy that thing that made radio special, like you were talking
right.
about. So now they're going, because podcasts can't be music intensive.
No, you can't. People don't get that. I would have music all over this and great music.
Can't do
music
it.
You'd love, but I can't play it.
You can't.
I don't
afford
own
it.
The copyright. I could, yeah, if I paid millions of dollars in licensing fees to these publishing companies,
right.
ASCAP, BMI, CSAC.
CSAC. Yeah.
So
now the focus is back on content,
right.
where it should be. Now, considering this conversation we're having right now, nobody gives a crap about.
Yeah, it's wonky as hell.
I have no idea if anybody's listening to this. But this content will be the thing that wins the day.
Yeah.
And if it's good, the cream will rise to the top, I
sure.
hope.
I'm going to float to the bottom like a stone. But
no.
Taking that example one circle closer to the source, going back to, you know, I said radio, you know, basically started in the 1880s is when the technology
right.
you know was discovered, and then TV comes around 50-60 years later. I hate telling other people's stories, but Josh, our other cohort in this, was telling me a month or so ago, I was talking about we redid our kitchen and kind of took out part of the wall and you know, so it's like an open plan a little bit with the living room, and because there's a small living space in our house. The living room's small, the dining room's impossibly small, the kitchen was incredibly small. So bringing it all open made each of those parts seem a little bit bigger, ironically. But I was talking about doing that, and he said, you know, it's funny. I realized our old place was built for radio. I'm like, what are you talking about? What do you mean? He said, well, the old place that we had, it was the living room was a long hallway, and it was like 10 feet wide by 30 feet long, and there was a fireplace right in the middle of it on one wall. So we're trying to think, where can we put the TV? you know, we had this TV on a stand. You can't put it in the fireplace. You can't put it opposite the fireplace because then you're sitting in the fireplace to watch it. You can't put it at one end because that's where the windows are. You can't put it at the other end because that's the hallway. So there was only one place to put the TV, and that was up above the fireplace. And that's how I convinced Cindy to let me get a plasma TV and spend a whole bunch of money on it. And that I realized he was right. It was built in the 1940s by... And, you know, our house was built in 1944 by camel-smoking men that were too feeble to go to war, older guys. And it was before the advent of TV.
Yeah. Yeah.
My living room is so small, I can't put it on one wall because you'd be sitting where the door opens. Can't put it on the window. There's only one wall it would go on. And it dawned on me, wow, that's right. And now we're living in the same places, but we're adapting our technology to suit those places, and they're real growing pains. And is there a place for radio anymore? I think there is. I'd like to think there is. I think radio is fun. It's exciting. It's live. There's no net for the most part. There's a dump button if somebody, you know, drops an F-bomb, but for the most part, it bristles with life because it's happening right then.
Right.
But I don't know. I don't think people are getting more and more excited over it over time. And part of the reason, if they would have put the FM chip in cell phones, so it would have been easy. If my cell phone would be an FM radio,
right.
I think that would have helped the industry a lot. But I don't think that was ever in the best interest of the Apples and the Samsungs of the world.
Well, your kids are too young to kind of watch what their habits are right now. But I got a 26-year-old, and I watched him grow up. He wasn't born with the internet, but he grew up with it, basically. Yeah. And so it was really interesting to watch Alex discover music in a way that I didn't. I discovered music because it was what my sister was playing. I was listening to Top 40 radio. If you had a cool friend who had better taste than you, you were kind of trying to follow his trend. Yeah. Alex, having the internet, he and his buddies found Nirvana. Like, stumbled upon Nirvana, and suddenly he's listening to Nirvana. And I'm going, dude, Nevermind came out the year you were born.
Yeah.
The baby, the naked baby in the pool on the cover of Nevermind
is one year older than you.
And how did you find, and it was just, and suddenly he's listening to Led Zeppelin, and
Did you know that Paul McCartney was in a band before Wings?
But he'll be listening to, you know, Muse, and I'll go, oh, you know who probably influenced them? It sounds like here's a little Queen and here's a little ELO, and kind of give him all these other influences and stuff. So for him, it was never about necessarily listening to the radio. It was finding stuff. And his taste developed based upon that, and he was never influenced by what was being played on the radio. So radio has become more and more and more about the familiar, but it's also of a certain age. There are still Top 40 stations that target younger demographics, and they're doing very well. And Kiss FM here in town has varying degrees of success based upon doing that. But they're still doing okay. Mm-hmm. But there is a generation that doesn't need radio for music.
Yeah.
So that's the thing that worries me the most, is that we're so ingrained in here on the FM dial of providing these kind of familiar songs.
Yeah. Radio is the landline phone.
Yeah. Yeah.
That not many people have anymore. You know, everybody's got a cell phone, but not me. Enough about you.
Were we talking about me?
Actually, I wanted to ask about what drew you to radio. I mean, do you remember a specific radio station in Texas that you listened to, and what was your first experience in radio?
I definitely do. I think we all do, because I did grow up in the era of the boss jock. You know, it's that big, loud, fun, brash.
I'm a boss jock playing the Boss 30. My boss told me to play.
But I didn't have access to... I was fairly isolated in West Texas, Odessa Midland area, so I didn't hear WLS and these, you know, huge signals booming out of places, although at night I could actually pick them up.
They take the leaves off the trees at night.
Yeah, but... But we had local stations, and those guys were trying to be like the big guys. They knew what they sounded like. And we also had a bunch of guys that were just that came there and got their, you know, their first jobs from the Midwest and Arizona and all these other places. So it wasn't a bunch of twangy West Texas guys. It was, you know, these crazy guys out of Illinois who, and they had characters, and they were, you know, screaming over records, and they were having so much fun. And I recognized a lot of people from my era would have like a little, you know, cassette recorder, hold down the red button and push play so it would record and record songs off your transistor.
Yeah.
My God, I'm 1,000 years old.
No, I've been there.
When I got to the point where I was taping the jocks' breaks more than I was taping the songs, I realized, I'm really interested in what they're doing. I mean, they were also local celebrities to me. I was very much a TV kid. I was a latchkey kid. I enjoyed comedy and entertainment, and these guys were fun, and they were right there in town. So it was a combination of that, and also just coincidentally, my sister, one of her best friends, Susan Elsner, was the daughter of a guy who owned radio stations in town. And it was a light FM. I mean, FM was not a huge deal then, so it was a wimpy-ass radio station. But I got to visit it and see the place and the equipment. And oh, this is really happening here.
What was radio like in the 40s?
No, this is the 70s.
Okay.
The 70s, Andy. Still makes me feel just old enough. So
a little England Dan and John Ford Coley.
Well, the great thing about that was Top 40 at the time was as widespread as, and especially in Odessa, Texas, they played everything.
Sure.
I would hear in the span of 20 minutes a Billy Joel song, a Stevie Wonder song, and Deep Purple, Smoke on the Water. I mean, it was like, it wasn't that there were no restrictions, but those were hits. There was no splintered formatting and stuff.
Top 40 was schizophrenic.
And that progressive FM radio thing, that didn't hit. I mean, the first Top 40 on FM in Odessa, Texas, was one I helped put on in 1984.
Wow.
And we were getting calls from a bunch of, you know, Texas hicks going, what are you doing playing that jungle music on the FM? It took a little while for them to get used to it.
And by jungle music, what was it?
Stay With Me Tonight by Jeffrey Osborne.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I even had people call me up and ask about that song and go, where can I find that at Musicland? Turns out you had to go to the soul section at Musicland. So the influence of music on me was just this great widespread. I didn't necessarily put those things in categories, but that was kind of what spurred me. I was a creative kid. I was trying to make Super 8 movies. But the outlet of radio was kind of that more accessible, there's something I'd like to do because that sounds like a blast and I think I'd be good at it. Here's the kind of lurid part of the story. As a sophomore in high school, I knew that one of my classmates was dating one of the very much older disc jockeys at the local radio station. And at the time, that didn't even occur to me. In later years, I'm like, ooh, yikes, radio guys, they're gross.
Yeah, creepy.
Yeah.
Anyway, I asked a 16-year-old girl.
Statute
of limitations is probably passed on that.
It was West Texas, all bets were
right.
I asked her if...
they were also related.
No, stop it. I asked her if I could, meet the guy and maybe just, it was their job. And he threw me in front of a microphone, ripped AP wire off the actual AP.
Rip and read.
Had me sit down and read news into a microphone, left him a tape. He called me and said, you're terrible, but gave me a job Sunday nights running Casey Kasem's American Top 40 off of vinyl.
I loved it.
All of us did that. That was all our first jobs.
Oh, yeah.
And then so I was like 6 to midnight on a Sunday. And here was the great thing about that. One, I was 15, so I didn't have my driver's license yet. So my poor mother had to drive the station wagon out to, this was an AM station outside the city limits. They had a giant tower back there. So she had to drive there at midnight to pick me up. She was in her like robe and slippers and pissed, just
curlers.
Pissed. But she was trying to be encouraging. And at midnight on Sunday, because of, I guess, the restrictions locally, I would play the
national anthem
sign-off cart.
Oh, okay.
Eventually, I got to actually read that live. Today, this ends KOZA's broadcast day. KOZA is owned and operated by Odessa Broadcasting, et cetera. And then I would get to walk over to the giant RCA transmitter, tubes and wires, a big red switch, and flip it down and watch everything go, and walk out the door and lock it behind me. And I would be a 15-year-old, literally, was in control of every aspect of that broadcast entity.
Wow.
And I'd walk out the door and go, okay, mommy's taking me home now. So that was...
She had a snack for you.
No, she was not happy. No, she raced home as quick as that station wagon would go, slammed the door, and went to bed. But she was very encouraging about my budding career.
There was something special about it. Because, again, back then... Three networks.
Yeah.
You know, there were only a few places to go for entertainment. And half the radio stations that there are now, they dropped a bunch of them in 1997, you know, new frequencies and so forth.
Right.
Deregulated a bunch of the FM dial.
Yeah, it's hard to believe because it seems like even on radio there's a bunch of choices, but there were a bunch more at one time.
Yeah.
Especially in big cities.
That's really interesting. And one of the things that I've noticed about you is that you continued... You know, you were already doing – so I remember I was doing radio in Lafayette, Indiana, and thinking, I don't know, I'm kind of nervous about doing this. And then you do it for a little while, like, I could totally do this.
Yeah.
Oh, but in Indianapolis, they're really good down there.
Right.
But then you get to Indianapolis, it's like, I could totally do this.
Yeah.
But Los Angeles, they're really good out there. I couldn't. And then you get here, it's like, I could totally do this. Many of the people doing this aren't that great. Not to impugn other people's work, but in fact, I know I could do that just as well.
Many of these people would be bad in Indianapolis.
And so you get to that level. It's kind of like, you know, in sports, you know, a bunch of kids play in high school. But only a few get it to college.
To college, right.
And many thousands of playing in college. Tiny fraction get to the pros.
Right.
It's the same way with radio. A tiny, tiny fraction of the people get to a market like Los Angeles.
Right.
And once you get there, you think, I made it. But I always noticed that you continued to try to do things to get better at it. You were going to improv classes and you know, taking these things at Upright Citizens Brigade and other places where you wanted to learn how to get better, improve your mousetrap.
Yeah, and that was partly just a personal thing. That was kind of a personal challenge. I think I discovered how much that, the improv in particular, enhanced the radio part of me just from the tenets of, you know, listening and supporting and yes-anding and that sort of thing. But I think I was taught early on, even from people who were very complimentary of me, that I could always get better. I mean, I think at the beginning I was flying blind like we all are. And then you start to, I'm sure there was a jock that you essentially lifted his style or material at first.
Yeah.
Mine was
yeah.
Big Ron O'Brien. When I heard him in L.A., I'm still stealing stuff from him. And
the key is to steal just a little bit from everybody.
Yeah.
And then nobody will catch you.
But then you recognize I can't do that anymore. I hear comics and actors and other people say the same thing. It's like then at some point you begin to recognize what your kind of personal thing is.
Mm-hmm.
So I've luckily always had, most of the time, I've had people guiding me who I was never averse to getting constructive, you know, criticism about what I was doing. Lots of times it was completely benign stuff. It's like, okay, you either don't get me and don't like what I do. And if I was working at a place like that, I would leave that place.
Right. And sometimes you get that advice from jackasses.
Yeah. Yeah.
People
who just felt like they had to say something.
Right.
And that's not, you know, that's sometimes they just feel like they have to kind of legitimize their job.
Right.
But yeah, I don't think I've ever been anywhere where I didn't think I could get better at it. Even though it becomes second nature for us. And, you know, there is an aspect of walking in that room that's easy. And I worry about that in anything that I do, that I, and maybe that just come with time and a little bit of wisdom, is that if it's rote and it's mm-hmm. easy and it's comfortable, that's now a red flag for me. Yeah. So either I need to stop doing it and do something else or get better at the thing I'm doing so that I'm challenged more.
Somebody asked Jack Lemmon late in his life. They said, you know, when you perform at this point, you know, you're in your 70s. When you go out on stage and do a live performance, do you still get nervous? He said, oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, really? He goes, yeah, the minute I'm not nervous to go out on stage, I don't want to do this anymore. Mm-hmm. And there's something in that of what did David Letterman say about, you know, people said, used to tell him that he was at his best when things went wrong.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
When you know, things just went.
That's my whole career, man.
Yeah, when things go haywire, that's when he's at his best.
Yeah.
And he says,
Carson was like that too.
I hear that. I hear that a lot. But for me, at the time, it just feels like the studio's filling up with room temperature saliva. But that's where the rubber meets the road. And that's where when you do music intensive radio, you don't get a chance for that. When I was doing with Mark in the Morning, where it was four songs an hour and much more leeway to do content, then that's when things can go wrong. You know, if you don't have a song to bust into to get you out of that break, then that's where awkward things can happen. Yeah. And those are the things that people remember.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And unfortunately, I think because of, you know, I'm not doing mornings these days, and even when I've done mornings, it's been a kind of a tighter restriction. It's mm-hmm. it's hard to, there is a nugget of creativity that you're constantly searching for. I think that was one thing at The Sound. I was very tightly restricted in terms of amount of time. And when I had a partner join me, Sherry Donovan, that didn't expand
right.
the palette. It was now you've got two people basically doing
the same amount of time.
Short yeah. amount of time. So that
talking 2 minutes and 2 minutes a break twice an hour.
So I took that as a challenge to try and make sure every break was really distinct and that was it was hard. I mean, but and I don't know that we were successful at it, but I still looked at that as a challenge. As like, okay, can I make that 2 minutes memorable and not just sitting here wanking my crank for, you know, and hearing the sound of my own voice. I never want to be that.
Wanking your crank.
Yeah, no, certainly not on the air. I haven't tried it yet, but I'm thinking about it tonight. But yeah, that's where you talk about improv and doing the podcasting. I mean, I think for us, these other outlets are a godsend from the standpoint of just being able to have a voice outside of what's somewhat limiting, you know, our personality comes out and there's a style and there's some sort of, you know, there's effort involved.
Yeah.
But this, we have something to say. And I think we both, I mean, I've always thought of you as a slightly humorous human being. I mean, there's, you know, other ways to express that. And that's why I did improv. And that's why I like doing the podcasting. I think that's why you have done acting and your voiceover work and those kind of things, is that we can't be just that one thing. And at least personally, I have to find those other outlets. Otherwise, I would never be satisfied going in and just doing a shift.
Yeah, it'd be no fun to be around.
Yeah, I'm barely any fun right now.
Well, in the weeks to come, I'm hoping that you and me and Josh, and I'm crossing my fingers that we can get Sam Farmer of the LA Times.
I think you can do
to,
it.
To join us. And
you still got some juice in this town, Mr. Chanley.
You think I'm calling it chit? Calling it chit.
Oh, hey.
See
what's
if
your,
I,
what's your language
see if I can
this
get
thing.
Get him involved in
that'd
this
be great.
Too. Get to know Sam, and in a revolving door here of the four of us and other comers and guests, because I think we can have a lot of fun. I don't have any proof of this.
Yeah, not from this past hour.
Yeah, not this. This is no indication that there are better things to come.
But this Larry, is the best conversation you and I have ever had. So if it
yeah.
means that this is our excuse to get together and actually talk seriously about stuff, then I'm all for it.
Yeah. And this is the getting to know you episode two of this podcast with Larry Morgan. Larry, thanks for joining us here at the end of your career to spend an hour.
No, it's your career that's ending. I'm doing fine. Let's make that very clear.
Fair enough.
Was that mean? Was that cruel?
Yeah, it wasn't. Okay. Words hurt.
Sorry.
I threw this out at the end of the last one. I should probably do it every time. I'm totally ham-fisted and new at this, and I don't know what I'm doing. But Andy Chanley, A-N-D-Y-C-H-A-N-L-E-Y, at me.com. If you have any words of encouragement or you'd like to pass around a petition to ask us to stop this, that's where you can reach me. Do you have something?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Larry_Morgan. Because the kids love the underscores.
I'm Andy_Chanley on Twitter.
Look at that.
Huh. Great minds.
Hey, man, and if I can just kind of throw this in as a genuine kind of warm little moment, I love what you do. I think your personality on the air is great. I think you're a good human in person. I have, not to make it sound like really weird or mushy or creepy, but I have a great love for you and you and your family and how you treat other people. And I'm sad that your radio situation is ending, but you have a great deal of talent and you're a good guy. And I think there are great things ahead for you. So, and thank you for letting me be a part of this. And yeah, I'm excited because maybe we actually will see each other once in a while.
Larry, are you dying?
Yes, I am.
It was really nice. No, thank you. Thank you for saying that. And it goes double E's for me. Been a fan for a long time. They should have let us have a show together, Larry.
Well, this is it.
Whether you like it or not.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, join us next time on this here podcast.
And that's a wrap.
Doink.